So good morning, everyone. My name is Brian Keller, and I'm a technical evangelist for Visual Studio. Specifically, my team focuses on application lifecycle management capabilities. So if you were able to attend my foundational session yesterday, you would have seen me cover a wide range of capabilities that we focus on by trying to extend Visual Studio and Team Foundation Server to really focus on not only helping you as programmers to be more productive, but going really from the idea or the inception of an application or a requirement all the way through making sure that you're building the right requirement into great software, testing that, deploying that, and eventually as your software is running in production, being able to get bugs back from production as well. And so along the way, we noticed that there's a lot of potential for disconnects in that system as you move from one role to another. When you go between a stakeholder who's giving requirements into the programming team, into the testing team, and then into the operations team, every time you have to make one of those hops, it gets to be more and more challenging. And it's kind of like the old game of telephone, where I say one thing and someone else kind of, you know, says something else. And by the time it gets to the other end, it's completely different. And so along the way, we want to provide you with great tooling throughout the Visual Studio family to help bridge those gaps. And so today I'm going to be focusing specifically on a gap that we started addressing in Visual Studio 2010, and that is the bridge between developers and testers. So I'm going to go through several phases. The first thing I'll do is I'll kind of talk about how we got into the software testing business with Visual Studio, and then we'll jump into some demos. For those of you that I asked earlier who's using the Microsoft Test Manager 2010 tooling, I will be covering some of that tooling from the ground up, so just bear with us as we get through that, and then we'll get into some of the new stuff around Microsoft Test Manager 2012, as well as the new lab management capabilities, and if the network stays up, cross your fingers, then we'll have a fun Windows 8 demo as well. Before I forget, my email address, if you want to contact me afterwards, is just brian.keller@microsoft.com. So I'm always happy to hear from you and do anything we can to help support you after you start trying this stuff out. I just celebrated my 10-year anniversary at Microsoft, and I've never been prouder to work at the company. There's a lot of great stuff going on. If you're ever in Redmond, stop by Building 40, and I'll buy you lunch. We just got a brand new cafeteria, actually. I've been on Visual Studio almost the entire time, a brief stint on the Xbox team, but my heart really is around developers. I'm on Channel 9. I post all of my content on my blog, so you'll find links to my sessions, previous sessions I've done. You'll see the virtual machines, actually, that I use for all of my presentations. I package those up so that you can download them and take them back home, and there's actually scripts that you can run through to do pretty much all of the demos that I'll be showing you this week. So I would encourage you to download the virtual machine. There's hands-on labs in there, demo scripts. I think I just shipped the RC virtual machine has something like 18 demo scripts, and I believe that about 10 of those are actually focused on software testing, so it's a nice way for you to get started. One of the nice things about a virtual machine, of course, is that it already has TFS, sample data, sample users, all that stuff, so it makes it a lot easier for you to start to evaluate that. I've written a couple of books on 2010, and I'm pleased to finally be able to announce that we actually have 2012 books available as well. So those cover kind of everything that I'll be talking about this week. So we're going to start by talking about manual testing, and like I mentioned, we'll focus on 2010 capabilities first. And the approach that we delivered with 2010 was really focused around formal testing and the idea of starting with a test case or really starting with a requirement, writing test cases based on those requirements, and then running those test cases in a systematic way based on the newest builds that are coming out and eventually looking for regressions, and you know the drill. So we have a great set of tooling that supports that in 2010 that, of course, we've carried forward and has some fit and finish feature work in 2012. But the other thing that we've really embraced based on the industry trends that we're seeing is this concept of exploratory testing or agile testing. And I saw a few hands go up when I asked earlier. And so I'll show you how you can not only take advantage of formal testing, but also exploratory testing and really blend both of those approaches together. So I think we've got kind of an innovative approach to let you pick and choose the best types of testing for the types of test cases you need to run. Then I've got a demo around testing Windows 8 applications. And then what I'll do is I'll show you how to set up a lab managed environment. Now, I saw some hands earlier for folks that had tried lab management in the past. If you had set up lab management in the past, you've probably gone through a lot of work to set up first a System Center virtual machine manager environment. And then from, I see some heads nodding already. And then from there, you then have to set up a number of VM templates, and you're required to use Hyper-V. There's just a lot of prerequisites that in 2010 went into setting up these lab managed environments. And we've heard a lot of feedback that people love lab management, but they want to reduce the amount of setup time that it takes to actually set those up. And so I'm going to show you a new type of environment that we've introduced that's called a standard environment that doesn't require System Center Virtual Machine Manager. It doesn't require Hyper-V. In fact, you can even use physical machines or machines that might be running in VMware or even the new Azure VM roles that were announced this month. And then at the end, I'm going to wrap up just by showing you some of the ways you can track quality across your entire system. So I like to kind of start things off by reminding us why quality is important. Here's some fun examples. This is the USS Yorktown. This was one of the first ships that the US Navy branded a smart ship. And of course, anytime you put that kind of project name, you know that you're just asking for trouble, right? So one of the first times they took this ship out, a crew member entered a zero. It caused a divide by zero, and it actually caused the ship to be dead in the water for almost 3 hours. So I really don't want to be the poor crewman that entered the zero and had to explain that he just shut down the ship. I really don't want to be the software tester who is responsible for testing that scenario. I'll pick on the European Space Program here with the Ariane 5. Some of you might be familiar with this one. Basically, they reused some code from the Ariane 4, just assuming, hey, it worked for Ariane 4, so it must work for Ariane 5, of course. And it didn't. It took a different flight path, and this caused the rocket to explode. Nobody was hurt, but it cost about $500 million in 1996 prices. If you like these examples, by the way, there's a great presentation from a few years ago called An Illustrated History of Failure. And it was presented at OSCON, and the presenter goes through and he attempts to quantify the value of a human life by dividing the number of working years and the country's output and GDP, and he gets something like 2 million euros is the value of a human life on average. And due to the magic of software, he says, it's possible to not only eradicate the value of your life, but those of thousands of your peers as well with a single bad line of code. So part of the reason that I'm excited about testing is to make sure that nobody I work with shows up in a future Illustrated History of Failure presentation. I was also in Stockholm a few months ago, and if you've been to Stockholm, you have to check out the Vasa Museum. This is a ship that went down in the early 1600s, and it went down on its maiden voyage, and it actually just sank to the bottom about 1 nautical mile out of Stockholm. And as it turns out, there's a couple of things we can learn from this project. Number one, they actually added a second row of cannons up here because they wanted to make it a really impressive ship. The problem was that they didn't also account for additional ballast down here, and so it made the whole ship top heavy. And so I think that shows us the value of going through a proper change request procedure to make sure that you reevaluate all of the impact that has on your requirements. But the other thing that's interesting about this is that they actually did, in fact, test this boat prior to sailing it. And the way they did it is they had people, sailors, up top that ran from one side of the boat to the other and back 3 times. And they noticed that the whole ship was listing like this. And they said, stop the test. If we keep testing this, it's going to sink the ship. And they said, this test clearly failed. We cannot sail this ship. And guess what? QA was ignored. And they sailed the ship anyway. And of course, you know the rest. So If I'm going to make fun of, you know, some of these famous examples, I work at Microsoft, the largest software company in the world, so we'll pick on ourselves for a little bit. I'm not exactly sure how you would go about closing this application. I actually worked on Visual Studio Express back in 2005, so I can take partial credit for this one. This file is still copying to this day, 10,559 days. This is my favorite. An error has occurred while displaying the error that has occurred while creating an error report. These are real, folks. Does anyone see the problem with this? It's missing a period. Other than that, it's a fine error message, right? And just, okay. You know, what else are you going to say to that? So what do we do about this? Well, when we set out to get into the software testing business again with Visual Studio 2010, actually, we took a look at the entire software testing ecosystem, and we came up with a few key tenets that we wanted to support. The first of those I like to talk about by comparing to a hobby of mine, which is rock climbing and mountain climbing. And what I like to do is I like to, you know, spend a lot of time in the gym up front, training and conditioning and kind of getting myself back ready into shape. I'm not in shape right now, but I'd like to be. And the cost of failure, if you jam your finger or if you fall from a few feet, is very, very low when you're in the gym. And even when you're on kind of like a few-hour conditioning hike, it's not so bad. Maybe you sprain an ankle and you have to limp back to the car. But by the time you get out on a mountain and you look behind you and you see this big storm cloud coming in, this is actually me on the top of my first glacier summit. About 20 minutes later, we got hit by a 50-kilometer-an-hour hailstorm. At that point, you're really making sure that you tested your gear and your escape plan and your team and everything else, because the cost of failure is really, really high. Software testing is no different. If we can give you great tools within the development environment that can catch bugs as you're writing code, then that's going to help save you time. Maybe you introduce a line of code, it breaks something, you fail a unit test, you fix it. You know, maybe it's 20 minutes of your time. But we have done a lot of work over the last 15 years in Visual Studio. We knew the next step was, let's help you catch those bugs in the test environment anytime we can't actually catch them in the development environment. So by the time you get out to test, it's a little bit more expensive. You're starting to set up these environments that resemble production, but it's going to be a heck of a lot less expensive than if your customers are telling you that you have a bug. So we know that it's important to invest in that quality up front and really drive that quality closer to where you're doing your programming. So that's one tenet. The next thing we did is we looked at the entire industry, and what we noticed was about 70% of the testing that happened. Actually, let me go back. At the far left end of the spectrum, these are people that wake up every day and they do manual testing. They look at a set of test cases, they look at the latest builds that are coming out, and they run through those test cases and they file bugs. The far right end of the spectrum, these are usually developers who are writing code that tests other code. Maybe it's unit tests, maybe it's load tests, maybe it's, some kind of performance test. But what we found is that about 70% of the testing still takes place on the left end of the spectrum. And there's some good reasons for that. Number one, humans are smarter than computers, right? If you're a human and you're looking at an application and you can visually inspect the application, you might be able to determine, hey, wait a second, this just doesn't look right. My users are going to be confused, or there's a bug in here that we need to file. Whereas when you're writing automated testing code, you have to think in advance and say, I'm going to check for that. So that's one good reason. The other good reason, of course, is that as applications are quickly changing, you don't want to necessarily invest in a lot of test automation until those have stabilized. So manual testers are always going to have a job. They're always going to be in high demand. The problem with this is that over the last 10 or 15 years, most of the tools that have come out either from vendors or from the open source community have really been targeted at that right end of the spectrum. I mean, how many unit testing frameworks and web and load testing frameworks do we have out there? But really, these software testers, in a lot of cases, are still using rudimentary tools like Word and Excel to track all of their test cases. So we knew that we wanted to give them some first-class tools to be more productive. Finally, we also know that when a tester finds a bug, it usually goes something like this. The tester finds a bug, they file it over the developer gives them a funny look and says, you know what, works on my machine. Right? That's happened to all of us, I'm sure. I've been on both sides of the equation. What is actually going on there? Well, chances are the tester really did find a bug, and chances are it really does work on the developer's machine. But remember, the testers are probably using a different environment. They might be using last week's build. They might have a different interpretation of the test case than the developer does. And so this usually results in a conversation back and forth where the tester says, hey, I found a bug. The developer says, well, what operating system, what build, you know, sends back a litany of questions. And you're going back and forth, especially if you have an outsourced testing team who might be in another country. This can take a long time to go back and forth and have this conversation. Well, that's wasted time. The challenge we see then is a lot of organizations say, well, the next time a tester finds a bug, they should fill out this 7-page report that details exactly what they were doing and attach some screenshots and yada, yada, yada. And the problem, of course, there is as a tester, you know, I just found a bug. Do I really want to fill out this report, or is that bug kind of not a big deal? Well, that's not the right behavior we want to encourage. So those are three things we decided to invest in. Number one, let's drive that quality up front. Number two, let's give manual testers a great set of tools so they can be more productive. And number three, let's help bridge that gap between developers and testers so that we can all be more productive and create higher quality software. Okay? So to that end, we introduced a new product called Microsoft Visual Studio Test Professional. I don't know why I'm pointing at this one with the laser. That doesn't help you. Visual Studio Test Professional, right up there. And in 2010, if you have Visual Studio Ultimate, it also includes Test Professional. The tool that you actually get when you buy Test Professional is Microsoft Test Manager. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Just understand that if you have either Visual Studio Test Professional or Visual Studio Ultimate in 2010, you'll have a tool called Microsoft Test Manager. You also get a license to Team Foundation Server when you buy that as well. That's required for the back end for all this testing. In 2012, we also took Test Professional and we made it a part of Premium as well. So for those of you that have Visual Studio Premium, you'll notice that you'll now have access to Microsoft Test Manager when you install the 2012 product. Okay? And this isn't a marketing presentation. If you have more questions about pricing and licensing, we can have those conversations later. I just wanted to set your expectations about where these products show up. Okay. So let's get out of slides for a while, and let me switch over to some demos. Okay, so like I mentioned, this is a virtual machine that you can download. So you can download this and go back and play with everything that I'm going to show you. This is Microsoft Test Manager 2012. If you've used 2010, it looks very similar to this. The first thing you'll notice over at the left-hand side here is that I have a list of all of the features that my development team is working on. And so these are just features that I've imported straight from Team Foundation Server. And they can be user stories or requirements, whatever it is that you're thinking of as the unit of work that you're delivering back to your end user customers. And then on the right-hand side, you'll notice a list of test cases. So here for this particular requirement, I have a couple of test cases. For this requirement, I have a few more test cases. And if we take a look at one of those test cases, you'll notice that it's written as a work item. So this is stored also as a work item within TFS. One of the reasons we chose work items for this type of artifact is you can start to do a lot of linking, and you can start to run reports. And as I'll show you later on, I can run a report that says, for this feature, how many test cases do I have? Or do I have any features that don't have any test cases written? Or I can go one step further. For this requirement, the last time all these test cases were run, did they actually pass for the latest build? So there's all sorts of interesting analytics that you can get as a result of that. But the important stuff for a test case is down here. You can see a list of all the individual test steps. So there's nothing fancy there. It's basically just a textual list of steps. What is a little bit interesting here is that if you take a look at this new quantity, for example, you'll notice it has kind of that Twitter-style syntax with the at sign. What that does is it actually creates a parameter column for you. So you can data bind this test, and you can use it over and over again. So if I needed to make sure that I could fill out a shopping cart and ship to addresses in the UK and addresses in the Netherlands, don't write the same test case twice. Just write a single test case and use different data. So let me show you what it looks like to actually run one of these test cases. Across the top, the two most popular tabs you'll be working with as a tester in here are Plan, which is where we're at now, and Test. And so when I come over to Test, this shows me a list of all of the test cases that I, as a tester, care about running. Now, a couple of things to point out. You'll notice that for this particular test case, I actually have it showing up twice. The reason for that is, if I expand this guy, the reason for that is that I actually have a test matrix defined within Microsoft Test Manager, and I'll show you where you define that. But let's say you need to make sure that this test case works correctly on Internet Explorer 9 and Firefox. Well, you just create a test matrix, and then you can apply that to all of the relevant test cases, and that way it will get run once for each configuration. So in this case, I'm just going to run this for my Windows Server machine. That's what I'm on right now. So we can go ahead and run this test case, and it's going to launch what's called Microsoft Test Runner. Microsoft Test Runner is what tells me as a software tester exactly what I need to do step by step. So these are the things that I need to be testing for. And it's also responsible for collecting a lot of rich data in the background that I can use to then later go back and file a bug. So I mentioned earlier, we want to eliminate that no repro scenario, and we also want to make sure that the tester doesn't have to manually go in and collect a lot of data every time they find a bug. So from the moment I click Start Test, it's automatically going to capture anything that I've configured in my test settings. That can include a video recording, it can include event logs, it can include IntelliTrace files. So there's a lot of interesting information you can collect. You can even write your own adapters here. So if, for example, as a developer, you know that every time you get a bug for this particular application, you really would like this custom log file that gets generated and saved out in the temp folder. With a few lines of code, you can write a custom data adapter that gets plugged in so that every time the tester files a bug, it just automatically goes out and fetches whatever file you need. So it's just a matter of habit. It's not something that a tester is going to accidentally forget if you just program that as part of your test settings. So if I run this particular test case, start this test, then it's telling me to open up Internet Explorer and start testing this for this particular set of test steps. Now, one of the other nice things about this, I don't know if, yeah, you can see it. I've highlighted the first six steps because I've already run this test before. The last time that I ran it, I captured what's called an action recording. And when I captured that action recording, I can actually play that action recording back, and it's just going to click quickly through my application and save my time as a manual tester. So if I know that I have a 30-step test case, for example, and the only thing that we're testing right now is the shopping cart functionality, I might want to fast forward through the first 20 steps, which are, you know, sign in as this account, add this item to your shopping cart, change the quantity, enter your credit card details, yada, yada, yada. And I'm just looking down here at the very bottom. So this is something that can help you be more productive as a manual tester. And it also means that it's less error-prone because it's just going to be playing back exactly what you did the last time. For this particular test case, what we're doing is we're just making sure that when the user types a quantity, like if they were to go in here and type 0, for example, and then click on the white space, we want to make sure that any invalid quantities are going to revert back to 1. So a very simple test case. Same thing if I type like the letter A or -5. We don't want to pay our users to shop from us. That would be bad. So we're just testing to make sure that all those values revert. And so at this point, it's reverted to 1. So it's telling me as a tester, quantity should revert to 1. I think you can see that over there. And all I'm going to do is go ahead and pass that particular step. And then just for fun, I can play back these last two steps here. Oh, I accidentally played the wrong steps. It's hard to see on my screen up here. Anyway, if I was to play those last two steps, they would have closed the browser. And let me just clean up my shopping cart there. Okay. So at this point, I'm pretty happy with that particular test case. And the next thing that I might do is go to the next iteration of data and do the same thing. And I won't waste your time with that. But basically, when I do it this time, it's going to be pulling up a different quantity from that row of data. So now it's telling me it's going to test with the number 0 and so on and so forth. So at this point, I'm feeling pretty good about this test case. We'll go ahead and close out of this. Another thing that, for those of you that are using Microsoft Test Manager 2010, one of the things that a lot of people asked us for is the ability to just quickly update the results of a test case straight from the Test Manager without having to launch into Test Runner. And what you'll see here is that we've actually done the same thing right here. So if I go to this particular test case, which has failed, and if I just mark that as passed, then it's going to go ahead and flip over as passed. Sometimes it's a lot easier if you know something's going to fail or you know something's going to pass, just to mark it as pass/fail without having to launch into Test Runner. So that's one of these small things, but a lot of people asked for that. Now let me show you behind the scenes a few of the settings I referred to earlier. If you click on Plan and Properties, this is where you can define a lot of the project properties for your particular test plan. One of those properties is the diagnostics that you configure. And these are called test settings. And I can have multiple test settings. So, for example, I might run with a lightweight diagnostics file that only captures basic system information and event log information. And then later on, I might turn on a more full diagnostics profile that includes IntelliTrace information, for example, if I know that the developers are really going to need a stack trace to show them exactly what's going on. And so if you look at the data and diagnostics here, I have a long list of things I can choose from. I can capture that action log, which literally just allows me to say, you know, the user or the tester clicked this button, they typed this text, they pressed enter. Now that is dependent on the type of application you're testing. So it works really well for Microsoft technologies, including Windows Forms, WPF. It works great for web applications, so it doesn't really matter what your back end is, whether you're using ASP.NET or JSP or JavaScript or anything that you're using on the back end, because we actually just operate at the DOM layer at that point, so we'll be able to get a lot of that interesting data for you. Some other technologies like third-party custom controls for like a WPF application, you might need to talk to your control vendor to make sure that they actually support Microsoft Test Manager and coded UI tests. So that's something you should raise with your control vendor. A lot of them are starting to ship support for that. And there's a test matrix in the MSDN documentation that shows you what is and what isn't supported. Event log, that's kind of a no-brainer. I can even come in here and turn on specific event logs. So for example, if I knew that security was something that we got a lot of bugs off of, I might want to turn on the security log so that I saw any audit failures. The other nice thing about test settings is you can actually turn this on a per machine basis. So if I was testing an application that consisted of a client, web browser, then a SQL server in the back end, and maybe another web server on the back end, I can actually configure test settings for every tier within that environment. And that way I can get really, really nice diagnostics. And so I can get an event log off of my SQL server. I can get an IntelliTrace file off of my web server. And then all that gets packaged up anytime I file a bug. So that makes it really nice to do that. We can also configure video recordings as well. And another thing to point out on the video recording is that you can capture a video recording even if the test case passes. And you might wonder why you want to do that. What I've seen a lot of people do with this is actually turn on the test video recording so that if you are outsourcing your testing to another organization, this makes it really easy for you to go back and audit them later on and make sure that they're actually testing exactly what you paid them to test. The other nice thing about this is that if you are running in an Agile team, a lot of Agile teams don't always take the time to write documentation about every single build or release that they put together. But occasionally you might have a stakeholder that says, hey, I'd really love to see how this feature is looking in the latest build. Well, all you need to do is go into a test case for that particular build, and if there's already been a test run for that build, just pull the video recording, and that's instant ad hoc documentation. So it makes it really nice for you to take advantage of that. Now you'll see a couple of other things in here that I haven't explained yet, like test impact, let me go ahead and show you test impact right now. If I go into the track tab, I have the option of picking what build my testers are going to test with. And so I can say assign build. And one of the challenges with figuring out which build you want to test with, especially if you're using, if you're testing in an agile team, is that you have a lot of builds coming out all the day, during the entire day. You might have a continuous integration server set up that's spitting out 20, 30, 40 builds a day. You might have nightly builds that are coming out. As a tester, I really want to know, when is it worth my time to pick up a new build? And so if you think about the tester's dilemma there, they oftentimes today have to go talk to the development team and say, okay, what did you check in the latest build? Did you fix that bug yet? Did you implement that requirement? Because I have a bunch of test cases that are waiting to test the requirement that you're still coding up. And that, again, is not a good use of the tester or the developer's time if we can get that information automatically. And so again, because we're using Team Foundation Server on the back end, as the developers are checking in their code and they're completing work items, we automatically figure out from the build reports what's changed in those latest builds. And so here, what you can see is that I have a particular build, build number 318.3. And then in the list below, I have a list of all the more recent builds that have happened since then. Down below, in this box at the bottom, shows me all of the work items that have been changed as a result of that latest build. And so I might take a look at this and say, okay, someone completed a task. It has something to do with writing a regular expression. Well, I'm sure that's very important, but that doesn't tell me anything in my test plan. I'm going to skip this build. It's probably not worth my time uninstalling the old one and installing the new one. However, if I look at a more recent build, then you can start to notice it gets a little bit more interesting. So now I actually have this user story that's being resolved. And so maybe I had some test cases that were waiting for that user story. And so now, all of a sudden, this build looks much more interesting. Or if I take a look at the latest build, it has, of course, everything that the previous builds had. It's all cumulative. And then we also have this bug that's fixed. And on my team, whoops. On my team, the process we follow is that a tester needs to make sure that they go back and test a bug if a developer says they fixed it so that we're sure that it's no longer regressing. So this build is worth my time, and I'm going to go ahead and assign this to my plan, which tells my rest of my testers we need to start testing against this particular build. Now there's another question that we also need to answer here as well. I just figured out a bunch of new things that I can test. I figured out I need to make sure that this bug is fixed. There's this user story I need to go start testing, which is great. That gives me plenty of work to do. But then there's another question, which is, you know, the last few days, I maybe ran 200 test cases. And, you know, all of those passed. I filed a couple of bugs. But for the most part, all of those test cases passed. We now have a new build. So there's a possibility that something that was working yesterday is failing. But which test cases do I rerun? I don't have time to rerun all 200 test cases right now. I should before we release this to the customer. But if I have, you know, an hour before I go to lunch, where can I spend my time running test cases that are going to have the highest probability of yielding some regressions for me? That's where test impact analysis comes in. Test impact analysis is a technology that runs in the background anytime you're testing .NET applications. And so you saw in the test settings that I could have enabled test impact analysis. The way that works is you start testing, say, test case number 51, and then it realizes that you're using, you know, classes foo and bar, and on class bar, you invoked these three methods. Then a developer comes back and changes one of those methods. And we trace all the way back, and we say, you know what? This test case number 51, the last time you ran it, it passed. But now there's some code that it depends on, which has changed in the latest build. You should probably consider rerunning that test. It doesn't mean it's going to fail. And it also doesn't mean that the rest of the test cases that don't show up as impacted are necessarily going to continue to pass. There could be external factors. Maybe there's some non-.NET code, like some C++ code that's changed. Maybe an external data source has changed. But it at least tells you, if you have an hour before you go to lunch, these are the 10 test cases you might consider running, which is going to give that fail-fast feedback back to the development team. And so when I assign this to the plan, it says there's some recommended tests that you want to consider running. If I view those recommended tests, then here are some test cases that passed the last time, and based on the latest build, they are now impacted, and you should consider rerunning them. So if I now say reset those to active, and I go back to my test tab, then they're now telling the rest of my testers, these are inconclusive. We need to consider rerunning these particular tests. Okay? Can I get the time running in the back? It didn't start when I started the session. I just want to make sure I stay on time. Thank you. So the next thing that I'll show you is kind of a different testing approach, and that is exploratory testing. So with exploratory testing, you usually don't start with a formal test case. You just get in there and you start testing the application. And there's some great literature that's come out from a colleague of mine, James Whitaker. James Whitaker actually started on the team that built Microsoft Test Manager several years ago. And then he went over to Google and did some testing for them. And recently he came back. So he actually pioneered a lot of the approaches around Agile. It's still thinking up here. There we go. Thank you very much. He pioneered a lot of the approaches around Agile testing. And the idea with Agile testing is that you put on a persona hat, and you get in and you start testing the application and just try to break it. You might spend a couple of hours pretending to be a hacker, or a couple of hours pretending to be, I like to think of my mom as a persona. My mom is terrified of using her credit card on the internet. And so if I'm Amazon.com and I'm trying to sell merchandise to my mom, one of the things that I might try to do is make sure that my mom can go online, look for inventory, find what she wants to buy, and then call somebody. So I might go through the entire experience pretending to be my mom, making sure that there's a phone number on every web page so that at any point in time she can pick up the phone and call someone. I might also make sure that there's a link to the privacy policy so she can read more and understand exactly what she's giving me versus not. If I am pretending to be my younger brother, he's more of a hacker. He doesn't do anything maliciously, but he likes to try to break stuff just to see if he can. And so my younger brother might get in there and, you know, try to overflow form fields or type in, you know, SQL inject statements into a form field and see what happens. And so these are different personas that you can assume, and you can get in and you can start working with your application and try to break it just like those personas might. Now, there's some criticisms with Agile testing. If I'm paying a tester for a week to test my application, and they say, you know what, instead of running these test cases, I'm just going to do Agile testing. And I say, well, what does that mean? Well, I'm just going to go get in and, you know, try to break the application. Well, how do I know what I'm getting for paying that tester for 5 days to go do Agile testing of the application? The other problem that Agile testing encounters is when managers say, well, how are you going to know if you're in an application for 2 hours and you find a bug at the end of that 2 hours, how are you going to know exactly how that bug was generated? And so these are some of the challenges that we've thought a long time about trying to fix and try to address so that you can really unlock the value of Agile testing without having these objections, so that you can really trace and you can say, this is what we're getting out of that particular exploratory testing session, and these are the bugs that we can easily go back and reproduce and explain to the developer. So let me just pause right there and actually jump right into an exploratory testing session. You'll notice this new tab across the top called Do Exploratory Testing. And when you do exploratory testing, you can either start just explore, and that basically launches an exploratory testing session without being bound to any particular work item. Or you can pick a work item from your backlog, and you can say that I'm going to explore around this particular requirement. So if you're implementing, you know, credit card payment with a shopping cart, and that's the requirement that you're implementing, then you might do exploratory testing around that particular requirement for an hour or two, just to make sure that it accepts all the right types of credit cards and that kind of thing. It doesn't really matter which one you pick at this point. The only difference is that if I find any bugs during this exploratory testing session, if I picked a requirement, they'll automatically be linked to those bugs, which makes it easier for me to go back and report later on against those particular requirements. But I'm just going to say explore, and I'm just going to get into my application and start testing. So one thing you'll notice right away is that, of course, we don't have any test steps. Because at this point, we're just relying on the individual tester to use what they know about doing exploratory testing and either pretending to be my mom or my little brother to try to break the application. The other thing you can turn on, of course, is you can turn on video recording. You can also turn on audio recording. So that's really nice so that you don't necessarily have to type notes all the time. You can just be going through and you can say, hey, I just noticed that this particular, table is formatted incorrectly. And then you can click file a bug. That automatically goes back to the developer. And they can listen to that and they can just quickly understand what you're doing. So that's one option you have just to kind of speed up the rate at which you're testing and finding bugs. At this point, I'm going to go ahead and start testing, which means that we're tracking anything that's happening within the application from this point forward. And I might just get in here and, kind of click around the application. I'm just looking for anything that kind of strikes me as a bug within the application. Remember, I could be in here for, 40 minutes or so before I actually find anything. And eventually, I might decide, that all looks good. What happens if we click on delete? And so if I click on delete, then I scroll down and I look at this and I say, aha, I found a bug. Notice that the customer is set to none and created by is set to none. Well, I'm pretty sure those should have values. So what I'll do is I'll grab a screenshot and I will go ahead and create a bug from that. And at this point, notice it automatically includes my screenshot down here. It also includes things like system information because I have the system information turned on. So my developer is going to know, what type of OS I'm running, what type of browser I was using in this particular case. If I come back to details, though, a lot of this information might be irrelevant. Notice that it captured everything that I did since I started this particular test case. So I clicked this link, that link, this link, that link. Well, I know that the first 10 minutes of my testing session were not really relevant to this particular bug. And so one of the things I might do as a tester is I might scope down this particular test result to just the last few actions, make it a little bit more easy for the developer to understand exactly what I did. And when I select just those last few actions, it automatically scopes those actions to what's relevant. And so I'll just give it a title, delete page is missing values. I'll sign it to myself, and we'll go ahead and save this. Now, the other criticism of exploratory testing is that, let's say that, I spent an entire day pretending to be my little brother, and I found a bunch of these bugs. And next week, I'm going to spend an entire day, doing a different persona. One of the criticisms is that you don't always find regressions if you follow that. So here, we found a bug. I'm going to file it to a developer. The developer is going to fix it. Clearly, this is an important requirement for my application to show those values on the delete confirmation page. How do we make sure that we can continue testing this moving forward so that if it breaks in the future, we'll find that regression? Well, what I can do is I can save this and create a test case directly from that. Notice what it did down here. It automatically pulled in test steps based on the actions I was performing. You'll notice, for those of you that use 2010 today, you notice we have rich text support. So I can come in here and say, do not delete the record. And I can make that red just so nobody deletes it. So just nice little things to make it easier for your testers to see exactly what's going on. And then here we can just name the test case, confirm that the delete page has the right values. When I save that, it's going to put me right back into the exploratory testing session. I can go find a bunch of bugs and spend all day doing this. And then once I'm done, I can end this testing session. It's going to give me a summary of everything that I did during that exploratory testing session. That's another nice thing that as a manager, I can go back and see what is the value of paying this tester to go test this particular persona for 2 hours. You might find that you found a lot of bugs when you're playing the hacker persona. That's something that you should probably know about, if you're trying to improve the application quality before it goes to production. And so if I now switch back over to my test plan, you'll notice that we now automatically have that test case. And so this is something that I can add to my plan moving forward so that once it's fixed, we can find some regressions. Okay? So those are two approaches, formal test case management, exploratory test case management. And the beauty is you don't have to choose. You can use both, and as you've seen, they kind of flow back and forth, so you can start in exploratory, and then you can generate your test cases over time as you start to find those bugs. Okay? Let me pause right there and see if anybody has any questions. No? Okay. Well, yes. That's an excellent question. So his question is it possible to test offline, say in a production environment where you maybe don't have a connection to the Team Foundation server that you're using? Is that the question? Yeah. Right now, it's not. That's something that we've heard a lot of feature requests for. I suspect we'll do that eventually, so you should consider that on our backlog. But what I would suggest now is you could set up just a lightweight Team Foundation server to collect that data, and then you could find some way of either periodically exporting the database and pulling it into your development and test environment, or kind of sneaker netting, you know, those databases over some other kind of synchronization. But right now, you will require an access to Team Foundation server. Now, I should mention, though, thanks for bringing that up, there's a lot of different ways to obtain Team Foundation server now. In case you missed it, we have a brand new Team Foundation Server Express product. It supports everything that I'm showing you today. It's limited to 5 users, but if you only have up to 5 users on your team, you don't even need client access licenses. It's free at that point. The 6th person that needs it and beyond, they need to get client access licenses, but there's a really nice scale-up model for that. My colleague Martin Woodward is doing a session this week where he'll start with Team Foundation Server Express, and he'll start from kind of zero and have it all installed and ready to go by the end of his session. Another thing you can do, of course, is you can use the tfspreview.com, which is the version of Team Foundation Server that we recently made available on top of the Windows Azure platform. As of 2 weeks ago, you can actually visit tfspreview.com. You can sign up for an account, and 90 seconds later, you're good to go. You don't need any invitation codes or anything like that. Everything that I'm showing you today, with the exception of lab management, will work with TFS Preview today. Lab management is something we want to support in TFS Preview in the long run, but I can't commit to any time frames right now. But you can do everything that I'm showing you from formal and exploratory test case management with tfspreview.com. Okay? And of course, you can continue to use the full-blown on-premises version of Team Foundation Server if that's what you have. Anything else before I kind of go? Yeah. So the question is, if you're running lab management, which I'll show in a few minutes here, do you have to have Microsoft Test Manager installed in those environments? Yes and no. So generally speaking, you don't need to have Microsoft Test Manager installed in the environment. The only exception is if you want to record action recordings within that environment and be able to play those back. So by default, kind of the standard setup that most customers use is they have Microsoft Test Manager running on their test machines, and then they can connect remotely via either our own terminal session within Microsoft Test Manager, you'll see this in a few minutes, or just via another like RDP or Citrix terminal session over to that other machine where they're running their manual tests. When that happens, we don't have the ability to get the actual click-by-click, type-by-type actions that you're performing unless you actually install Microsoft Test Manager in that client environment. So yeah, good question. That's another thing that we can do in the future. We just haven't done that work yet. So if I don't see you, please shout out. The lights are kind of bright, but I think that's everybody for now. Okay, so the next thing I'm going to show you is some cool stuff we've done around testing Windows 8 applications. And so again, if you're not yet building Windows 8 applications, then hopefully you will. But one of the things that we really wanted to enable with this experience is a very easy way of you testing an application on a Windows 8 tablet using the full Metro-style interface, but still be able to collect all the rich data that you're used to from these other sessions. And so one of the things that means is we don't necessarily want to pop up a Microsoft Test Manager that takes up 20% of the real estate on the left-hand side as you're running your test cases. And so one of the things we've done here is we've enabled a really nice remote testing experience. And so if I switch back over to my test, I have this Windows 8 test that I've written. I'll just show you that test case. We're just going to be using the built-in finance application. If you've used Windows 8, there's a finance application. It lets you look at stocks and kind of financial data. And one of the things that I've done down here is I've data bound this test to use two different stock tickers. One is Microsoft and one is Facebook. And so what we're going to do is indicate to Microsoft Test Manager that instead of testing on my local machine, I'm actually going to be testing on my Windows 8 tablet, which is sitting beside me. Now, what I'd like to do is find a volunteer who has not yet used Windows 8 who might want to come up and play with Windows 8 during this particular test session. Anybody feeling brave? It's really easy, I promise. All right, thank you very much. Round of applause for coming up, being a brave volunteer. What is your name?
Sergi.
Sergi, come on up. And basically, you're going to stand here, and I am going to start this test case. And what it's doing is it's connecting to the remote device over here. And you won't be able to see my Windows 8 tablet because it's not projecting. But what you'll see is what we're seeing as a tester looking at the list of test steps over here. And so when I say start this test, it's actually connected to this remote Windows 8 tablet. I've already supplied my credentials so it knows how to sign in. And it's basically going to tell Sergi what he needs to do in order to run through and test this application. So if you look at this list of test steps, it's asking you to open the finance app. So if you scroll over to the right, and then there's the finance app at the top there. Oh, sorry. There you go. And then the next thing it's asking us to do is view the data for Microsoft. And so if you scroll to the right and take a look at Mike, oh, you're doing great. There you can see the data from Microsoft. The next thing that it's doing is saying view this by day, which you're already doing. And that looks pretty good, right? Then let's view by week. That's looking a little bit down. That's okay. And then if we look by year and so on and so forth, all the way up to the full range there. And for the most part, this looks pretty good, right? Okay. So especially if you were at Microsoft since like 1984, which I was not, but that would be really nice. So at this point, what I'll do is I'll go ahead and pass this particular test case, and we'll move on to the next iteration. And so the next iteration here is going to ask me to do the same thing, but it's going to ask me to do it with Facebook. And so in order to get started, let's actually go back to the home screen. So if you scroll to the right there, there's the start menu. Mm-hmm. So there we go. So I'm going to start this test. And you're basically going to do the same thing. So he's scrolling over to the right. He'll click on the finance application. He'll open up Facebook. He'll look at the day. Day looks pretty good. Week looks pretty good. Now, at this point, what you can't see this, but I'm going to show you this in a moment. It's actually starting to look a little bit difficult for Facebook to render within this interface. And the reason for that is that Facebook's only been on the exchange for like, I don't know, two months at this point. And there's actually a bug in the finance application that if you shift the range to be longer than, say, 6 months, then the data actually doesn't render correctly. And so at this point, Sergey's found a bug. And I know that none of you can see his Windows 8 tablet. And so he's going to try to communicate that bug to the rest of you who might be a developer responsible for fixing this. And one way that he can do that, if you just stay right there on the 5 years, is he can come down to 5 years within the UI. And he can say, let's grab a screenshot. This is now showing you what's on the Windows 8 tablet. And so he can grab this screenshot here. And that will now be linked as an attachment to that particular test step. And he can then do the same thing down here for the full time range. And if you look at this, it's actually even worse because we're not rendering anything. So I feel like that's a bug. We can go ahead and fail that particular test step. Yeah, we can fail both of them if we want to. And at this point, we'll go ahead and create a bug. Notice that it automatically captured all of the test case information. So now as a developer looking at this, I immediately know what that test case looks like. You can see that this screenshot is, of course, included for me by default. So I can open that up, and I can see exactly what's going on. And the best part down here is when I click on Action Log, it's actually going to tell you exactly what Sergey was doing up here the entire time he was using that application. So here you can see he panned right, he clicked on the finance application, he tapped on the container, and so on and so forth until eventually he gets down here and you can start to notice that the application doesn't look correct. So thank you very much for finding a bug. Nice round of applause for Sergey. And so that's just one of the ways we're making it easier for you to get that rich data back to your developers. Question in the back. Oh, that's a great question. So he's asking if you can turn on IntelliTrace and be able to get rich IntelliTrace data from your Metro-style applications. Unfortunately, today the answer is no. We kind of track this as like a bingo card back within Redmond. So there's a lot of spots in the bingo card that the team is really busy trying to fill up so that we can. One of the other things that people ask for is like full coded UI support within Windows 8 so that you can just create a fully automated coded UI test, which, by the way, I'm showing tomorrow. Tomorrow afternoon, if anyone wants to come to that session. That's something that doesn't yet work with Windows 8, but it's something that the team is feverishly working on. So I hope that we'll have a better story for you there in the future. Yeah? Yes, you would have had system information here. So if I go back to this bug and click on system information, then that tells me I'm running the release preview. So you know, one of the things a developer may say is, hey, we don't support the release preview. We only support RTM. So, you know, I'm going to file this as will not fix or something like that, right? Yeah. Okay. So I think we have 20 minutes. Is the timer right? 20 minutes? Okay, great. Was there a question over here? Performance and load testing. So you're talking about like web performance tests and load tests. There's not a lot of changes in this particular release. So you sound like you're familiar with the previous versions of Visual Studio. There's not a lot of changes in 2012. One of the biggest changes is actually a licensing change that we introduced midstream after 2010 shipped. And basically what that said is that instead of having to go out and buy individual virtual user packs for conducting load testing, we actually let you use as much load as you want. And so you can just, as long as you have Visual Studio Ultimate, which provides the ability for you to author these web and load tests, you can point it at as many machines that you want to actually generate that load on. You'll go through and install test agents on those machines and create your load testing rig. And then if you want to simulate, you know, 10 million users hitting your site, you can do that. There hasn't been a lot of new features in this particular release around that capability. Yeah. Will Silverlight be supported for automated testing? That one's kind of on the border right now. So we, in 2010, we actually shipped a feature pack that provided automated testing support for Silverlight 4. I believe that they were in the middle of working on the support for Silverlight 5, and then they had to divert to some other projects. Right now, the current plan is that Silverlight test automation support is not going to make it into RTM of Visual Studio 2012, but I'm told that it should make it shortly thereafter. So shipped as a feature pack or as a free download, I'm not quite sure. But yeah, that's something that we know a lot of people are asking for. So if you need to support Silverlight, just you can continue to use Visual Studio 2010. In fact, if you own Visual Studio 2012, you can continue to have a license to previous versions. You have both of them on the same machine. Okay, great questions. Let me push forward just so I can get through the lab management capabilities that I want to show you here. And that's actually in a different virtual machine, so I just need to warm up that environment. So I mentioned a few of these things already, so that's just a recap of what I just showed you. So lab management is a really interesting space because one of the things that we see a lot of customers asking for as you move kind of into this agile world where you're doing multiple builds and making a lot of changes is a desire to set up these continuous deployment environments. I really want to be able to make a change over here to my code, build that, push it out to some environment that resembles my production environment, run a bunch of tests, and then be able to report back on the results. And that sounds easy enough, but being able to set that up in a lot of organizations is oftentimes a full-time job or the job of multiple people. And so we wanted to make that easier. And so in 2010, we introduced a capability known as Lab Management that allows you to orchestrate this entire workflow using Team Foundation Server, Team Build, and System Center Virtual Machine Manager. System Center Virtual Machine Manager is a product from the System Center team that lets you spin up virtual environments on demand. And so you can have a snapshot of a SQL Server environment and an Apache web server environment, and you can say, spin that up into a new environment for me. And then with Lab Management, you can go out and you can deploy your bits. So maybe I want to go, you know, get the latest source, compile that into some projects, deploy that out into this environment, and maybe push a SQL script out, push a web server script out. And then I can run all of my automated tests against that entire environment and then report back on the results. One of the really nice things that I get here is the ability to easily snapshot along the way. And so as part of our workflow, we actually have hooks that go down into System Center Virtual Machine Manager. And for example, we can create a snapshot before you run any of your tests, because some of your tests may actually break the environment, but you might want the ability to, at any point in time, go back to, say, Friday night's build, so you can see what that looked like. Another great use of snapshots is for you to take a snapshot anytime you find a bug. And that way, when I find a bug and I file it to my friend Adam, he no longer has to say, well, it works on my machine. He can actually just click the link for that snapshot. It's going to rehydrate that environment into the state that it was running in when I found that particular bug. And then finally, the other thing you can do with that, of course, is that you can use that as a manual testing environment as well. So now as a manual tester, I want to run those tests. I want to then connect to that environment and then run all the rest of the tests that are not already automated. Now, one of the challenges with that is just setting up this infrastructure in 2010 using System Center Virtual Machine Manager is kind of a full-time job, as I mentioned earlier. You have to have, of course, first Team Foundation Server, you need Team Build, you need a test controller, you need System Center Virtual Machine Manager, which is its own server and client infrastructure. You need to set up a template library, which is where you oftentimes sysprep images that you then want to generalize later on. So when you say, I need a new SQL server, it then spins that up based on a template and spins that up into a new running host somewhere. You also then have to go to each one of the machines in that environment. And this is 2010. You had to manually install a test agent, a build agent, a lab agent, and then wire those up to your test controller, build controller, System Center Virtual Machine Manager, yada, yada, yada. Just to get a hello world up was you know, usually a weekend for me, and I've done it multiple times, right? And so the team did a lot of really great work in this release to make this much easier. So one of the first things that they've done is they've consolidated the agents down to a single agent. The other thing we've done is we've made it so that Visual Studio is actually responsible, well, specifically Microsoft Test Manager is responsible for installing the agent on those environments and then automatically wiring it up to your test controller, to your build controller, and so on. And so that makes it a lot easier. But then the other limitation that we wanted to remove was the ability for you to use any machine that you want. So a lot of customers use Hyper-V, which is great, but I speak to other customers that say, you know what, VMware is our corporate standard. Or other customers might say, I'm testing hardware and software that relies on having direct access to special devices that are in the machine, and these machines can't be virtualized. How do you help me there? And so for those types of environments, we really wanted to enable you to take advantage of these build, deploy, test workflows without necessarily limiting yourself to System Center Virtual Machine Manager. And that's what we've done in the 2012 release. Now, there are some things that you have that are different between the two types of environments. So if you want to automatically snapshot and restore from within System Center Virtual Machine from within your managed environments, you have to use System Center Virtual Machine Manager. If you want to share those snapshots, like I mentioned, if you want to create what are called network fences, Maybe you want to have three or four environments that are identical, same IP address, same machine names as your production environments. System Center Virtual Machine Manager still provides you with a really great harness and platform for being able to do that. But maybe your primary development workstation is Windows 8, and you've got kind of an old server running in your office, and you just need to make sure that your code is compiling and the unit tests are passing and the coded UI tests are passing on a Windows server environment. Well, rather than go out and spin up a whole brand new lab environment, you can actually now just point to that other machine, supply it with the credentials you need, and then that then becomes an environment that you as a personal developer can take advantage of for pushing your code out anytime you have a change and seeing what happens. And so that's just one of the ways you can take advantage of it. I'm going to now switch over and show you what that looks like in 2012. Now, just in the interest of time, I did pre-configure this last night. It took me about 10 or 15 minutes for all of the software to install into the lab management guest so that everything was ready to go. So I did cut that out just in the interest of time. Why won't you let me accept you? There we go. But trust me, if we were to start from scratch and we had a little bit more time, we could set one of these up from the ground up. The way you do that is you basically come into Microsoft Test Manager. And previously, just to set your context, we were in the Testing Center. There's another Lab Center that gives you access to this lab management functionality. And what I did earlier is I just said new to an environment. I said, you know, this is my Windows Server 2008 environment. I described the machines that I want to work with. So this can be an IP address or a machine name. So if we connect to another machine in here, and then describe what the role is. We can have like a web server. I could add another machine that's maybe a database server and so on. These are the credentials that are going to allow me to install the agent on that particular machine. You can ignore most of this stuff. Configuring the environment for coded UI tests basically means that the agent can run as an interactive process. So if you need to run coded UI tests, you'll need to go through this step and say which machine within your environment runs those coded UI tests. And that just makes sure that it can take control of the mouse and keyboard when it's running through those tests. If you don't need to run coded UI tests, then you don't need to worry about that. And then at that point, if I was to say verify and finish, it would go out, connect to the machine, and everything would be set up and ready to go. And so that's what I have in this state, is I have a web server that I've just gone through that process with. It reboots the server a few times if it needs to install, you know, the .NET framework or the agent software and configures everything. And then once you're done, then it brings it up into this running state. And you'll notice down here that my test agent is now online. So this is now waiting to participate in a build, deploy, test workflow. The next thing that I've done is I've come over to Visual Studio and I've set up my build definitions so that I can describe what that build, deploy, test workflow looks like. Now, to do this, you actually need a minimum of two build definitions. The first is just your traditional compilation project. And so this is whatever you're doing today to build your projects and produce some output, whether that's an MSI or a web deploy project or a SQL script, whatever it is that you actually build as part of your solutions, that's what this first build script is going to take care of. The next one is the build definition, which orchestrates that build, deploy, test workflow. And so the only thing different that I've done for this build definition is I've configured it with this lab default template. And the lab default template has a bunch of activities in it which are responsible and understand how to actually deploy all the software out that you need it to. And so when I launch this wizard, it's going to ask me what environment I'm working with. So this is the environment I set up earlier. If I was using an SCVMM virtual machine environment, I would have the option of reverting to a base snapshot at this point. Because I'm not, then that's kind of left up to me to figure out how do I remove the last build before I deploy the new build. And that might be as part of your deployment script. You just blow away a web deploy directory. Or it could be that you are using VMware and you want to actually insert a new build task to kick in the VMware PowerShell script that rolls back that environment. So that's kind of left up to you if you need to revert your environment. In my case, it's all built into the deployment script. The next thing I do is I say that I want to kick off that previous build definition, which just compiles my project and produces whatever output I need. And then finally, we've got this web, this deployment script down here, which calls into whatever I do to deploy my software onto a clean machine. And so I just have made this easy. I have a deployment bat file, and I pass in a couple of arguments so that it knows where my build drop location is so that it can go pull the rest of the resources that it needs. It's a very simple batch file, so however you deploy your software today, you can just list sequentially the steps you need to run. So maybe on the web server, you run a web deploy. On the database server, you import a SQL Server database, whatever you need to do at this point. And then finally, this is the set of tests that I need to run in my particular environment. Let me go ahead and kick off this workflow. Actually, let me make a change just so you can see that this is real and that we're not doing anything fake up here. Let me go make a change. Just change one of these files in here. Almost there. So we'll change the create page. We'll change the title on this create page. And just to make sure that it's real and it's not faked, sir, can you tell me the name of your favorite beer? Pitbuller? Bit. I'm going to spell that wrong, but you'll just have to forgive me. I think he's saying Bitbuller. Is that close enough? Okay, I'm not going to it's hard to hear you, so let's just say that's close enough for now. So now what we're going to do is we're going to check in that file. I'll buy you one later, how's that? And then at this point, we will go back to builds, and we're just going to kick off that build. So queue new build. Now what it's going to do is it's going to build my software, including his favorite beer or something that's approximately what he told me. Then at that point, it's going to go ahead and deploy my software out to that running environment. And then the only other thing that I've done here is I've created a test case earlier, and I've actually mapped that to a test, an automated test. And that test was actually a coded UI test that I wrote earlier. And this particular coded UI test, I'll show you how to create in my session tomorrow. But the idea with a coded UI test is it basically simulates what a user is doing on a particular mouse and keyboard, and it can go through and it can add certain validation logic so we can validate certain values, and we can throw exceptions if a button is missing or something like that. And so let me just open this up so you can see my build workflow is running on the left-hand side, and this is the lab-managed environment. And so this is going to run for maybe a couple of minutes. It's going to build, push it out to the lab-managed environment, and then at a certain point you'll see this come online and say that it's running tests. What it does is actually just takes the test, pushes it down to the agent, and if it's a coded UI test, it'll launch the browser or do whatever it needs to do. If it's a unit test, it will just run in the background and report on whether or not things are working correctly. Now, there's a lot of really interesting things that I've seen done with this. If you go to Microsoft.com/case studies, there's a really great case study as well as a video that's on YouTube as well about ING. ING is a big bank in Australia. I think they're based in Australia. And they set up what's called a bank in the box. And what they can do is they can push a button, and something like 30 minutes later, they can get all of the systems in place for what one of their branch offices looks like. And so that's really nice for them to be able to quickly model an environment and take their changes and deploy it into their environment. The other thing that I've seen is the Xbox team. So the Xbox team has set up lab management workflows so they can go make a change. Now you can see it's running the coded UI test, and in a minute you'll see the beer that I fat-fingered up here. The Xbox team can make a change maybe to the way, there you go, Bitbowler. The way that leaderboards work or the way that achievements work. And they can push a button, and less than an hour later, they've got a full testing environment that's staged, that's run through all of their automated tests, and then they can actually wire up their dev kit so the playtesters can go in there and validate that everything is working correctly. So there's a really just, you know, an endless number of possibilities to get these all set up and working in an automated fashion. And so at this point, what you'll see down here is that this build ran through and it ran my tests. I can take a look at my test results. And you can see that that test passed. Of course, if the test failed, it would have additional information down here, maybe an IntelliTrace file, maybe an event log, maybe a video recording. And again, that's another nice thing for being able to turn on video recordings to run even if the tests pass, because you might want to go back and make sure that, hey, you know, functionally everything tested correctly, but maybe the browser just looks all incorrect, or the UI is, you know, upside down and backwards and written in Pig Latin. That's a nice thing for you to go back and validate just by watching the video that might be running on some remote machine in a data center somewhere. So I want to be respectful of your time because we're just out of time. So I will take questions after, but I want to thank you very much. This is one of my favorite topics to talk about. So I really appreciate you spending the last 75 minutes with me. Thank you very much.